Welcome to Murder Most Foul, a podcast devoted to exploring famous murder cases of our time. Some solved, some unsolved, but all fascinating and guaranteed to raise the hairs on the back of your neck. I'm your host, Jim Solanowski. Today's episode... Mississippi Burning. Mississippi Burning is the name of a motion picture released in 1988, starring Gene Hackman and Willem Dafoe, loosely based on the murders of three civil rights workers in Mississippi during the Freedom Summer of 1964. James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner were lured to Philadelphia, Mississippi, and executed by the Ku Klux Klan. No one was ever convicted of their murders until over 40 years later, when Jerry Mitchell, an investigative reporter with the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi, convinced authorities to reopen more than one cold murder case from the civil rights era, prompting one colleague to call him the South's Simon Wiesenthal. Author John Grisham wrote of Mitchell, "For almost two decades, investigative journalist Jerry Mitchell doggedly pursued the Klansmen responsible for some of the most notorious murders of the civil rights movement. His book, Race Against Time, is his amazing story. Thanks to him, and to courageous prosecutors, witnesses, and FBI agents, justice finally prevailed. It is my honor to welcome Jerry Mitchell to Murder Most Foul." Welcome, Jerry.
Thanks for having me.
No, thank you for being here. Jerry, the subtitle of your book, Race Against Time, is "A Reporter Reopens the Unsolved Murder Cases of the Civil Rights Era." Do you consider yourself a crusader?
I understand when people use that term. I mean, it doesn't, you know, in a sense, it's true. I mean, you know, you're essentially... the way I view our job as investigative reporters is we expose the truth, and you have to have the truth in order to get justice. So that's kind of the way I think about it.
So share with me your path to the Clarion Ledger, to your career at the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi.
Yeah, I mean, I got into journalism when I was in high school. You know, I was the editor of my high school paper. So, I mean, that's how far back I've been in journalism. And even before that, I read newspapers faithfully from about the time I was about 7 or 8, because my mom subscribed us to 3 newspapers. So I would read them, you know. And so I grew up with that. That's the way I grew up. And then once I really got into it for the writing, to be honest, you know, I really got into journalism and thought, well, this is a job I can do that they'll pay me to write. It was literally that simple. I started working for the Clarion Ledger in, 86. I kind of had worked for my hometown paper, worked for the Arkansas Democrat, worked for a small semi-weekly in Texas. And I'm from Texarkana, Texas, originally is where I grew up. And so then I made my way to Mississippi.
Now, Jerry, I have to confess, I'm a Yankee through and through. I've never been south of the Mason-Dixon line. So why don't you tell me and my audience a little bit about what Mississippi was like back then?
I grew up in the South. You know, East Texas, where I grew up, is definitely part of the South. And I grew up in the South and thought I knew about the South, you know, and I really didn't know anything about it until I moved to Mississippi. And then I began to learn that, you know, with regard to the civil rights movement, just these horrible killings and violence that took place, a lot of it in the South, basically carried out by the Klan, or sometimes not by Klan, to basically relegate Black citizens and others to second-class citizenship and or to prevent them from doing something, or if they're involved in the movement, taking them out, and destroying them or basically taking their power away in some way, in some way to just try to negate what they were trying to do. I don't know if you're like me, but if someone tells me I can't have something, I want it like a million times worse. And so there was something called the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission, which was this state segregationist spy agency that it was run by the governor. And so they existed from the 1950s into the 1970s, when the Mississippi legislature voted to seal all those files for 50 years. And so 83,000 pages of files, whatever, a lot of files. And so when I found that out, my first thought was, there's something in there, there's something in there. The legislature would not seal something for 50 years unless there was something in there. So I began to develop sources that access the files, began to leak me those files. And the initial leak I got on that, with regard to these cases, had to do with the Mississippi Burning case. And what I found out was, and Mississippi Burning is a name of a movie, which a lot of people will know it from that, but it was also what the FBI called the case. And the reason for that is because there was a church burning. The Klan burned the church down that was to basically draw the civil rights workers there. And that was kind of the whole plot and plan for the Klansmen to kill them. And that was James Chaney, who's African-American from Mississippi, and then Dickie Schwerner and Andy Goodman were both from New York City and came down to be a part of the movement. And the Klan killed them all, shot them to death, buried their bodies like 15 feet down an earthen dam. Really a miracle they were ever found. To back up slightly, I went to see the movie, or I was assigned to cover the movie, and happened to go see the movie with two FBI agents who investigated the case. So I'm all questions when it's over, because it's a fictional film, but it has like elements of truth in it, facts in it, some facts in it, but they're not, it's fiction, work of fiction. And so I'm all, yeah, I knew none of this. Like, this is all news to me. I knew none of this happened. And there's a whole, of course, this is far from the only bit of violence the Klan carried out in Mississippi and beyond. I mean, you had the White Knights in Mississippi responsible for at least 10 murders that we know of. I'm sure more, but at least 10. And those kind of things that were going on. What I couldn't figure out is there were more than 20 Klansmen involved in killing these three young men, and nobody ever, so a triple murder, and nobody ever been prosecuted for murder. And that, I couldn't believe it. I was just like, what? And so then I mentioned about the Sovereignty Commission records. It was about a month later that I kind of stumbled across my first, cache of Sovereignty Commission records, which were actually in the court file. They misfiled them. So they were supposed to, what they filed was supposed to be in the closed file, and the state of Mississippi had attached it to the motion. And so I saw that. And that was my first glimpse into those records, where they had infiltrated a civil rights group in Mississippi and basically stolen documents and photographs of Freedom Summer volunteers. And I'm like, wow. And so that got me curious about the Sovereignty Commission, the reason I wanted to go after that, because I wondered what else is going on. And I had this conversation with Ken Lawrence, who was a really valuable source, because he had read all the files. And sometimes we had to play games about it, because he couldn't say exactly. And then sometimes he could, because these were files he'd seen separately, apart. Like, he already had copies of them himself in some way. So Ken and I are talking, and I asked him what else is in the files. And he said, guess. And I'm like, I don't know, more theft? And it's like, no, no, no. What's the worst thing imaginable? And I went, murder. And there's this really long pause. And I was like, and he's like, now do you get it? And I go, yep. When I finally started getting those files, the first thing I got, kind of piecing things together, was about the Mississippi burning case. And it turned out that that the Sovereignty Commission had spied on Mickey Schwerner and his wife, Rita, and had basically given all those documents to the Meridian Police Department. That's Meridian, Mississippi Police Department. And the thing is about the Meridian Police Department at the time, more than half of those guys were in the Klan. The main shooter in the Mississippi burning case, his brother was one of the officers at the Meridian Police Department. So you know, people have to understand, Mississippi is a very small place. I mean, everybody's related to everybody or connected to everybody in some way. So you had sheriffs who were Klansmen. You know, he had the deputy sheriff in the Mississippi burning case, for example. And I think the sheriff was involved, too. I mean, there's certainly evidence of that. But certainly the deputy sheriff was involved. He was released, the three civil rights workers, about 10:30 at night. And basically into the hands of the waiting Klansmen. And that they were the ones that pursued them and took them out and killed them. It's obviously James Taney was driving, because he was the one that knew these roads, you know, not Mickey and Andy. In fact, it was Andy's first day in Mississippi. And he apparently tried to detour to, this is my theory, is there had this high-speed chase going down Highway 19, I think it is, toward Meridian. And I think what he did to try to escape them was he took a right turn, but I think what he didn't realize, like his lights were off or whatever, you know, like he turned his lights off. This is my theory. He turned off his lights and he made a right turn hoping to evade them. But what he didn't realize was when you touch the brakes, you're brake lights come on, you know. So you, unless you can make a right turn without touching the brake lights, it's which is very difficult at that kind of speed. So they obviously caught him. So
now, Jerry, the chronology of the Mississippi burning case is very clear in your book, Race Against Time. But for clarity here, I'll point out to my audience that the first trial was not for murder, but violation of civil rights, and that happened in around 1966. And in the late 80s, you were digging up evidence and writing articles in an attempt to encourage a prosecution of Edgar Killen, a clear ringleader, for murder. That didn't materialize until more than a decade later. Also, some of the cast of characters appear in more than one case, which you investigated and recount in your book, including Sam Bowers, the first imperial wizard of the KKK, who planned the murders of the three civil rights workers.
Well, Sam Bowers, the head of the Klan, who never gave an interview, I found out, gave an interview with the Mississippi Department of Archives and History, but it was sealed. So I wanted that interview. And so I, you know, reached out. It become part of the Dahmer case, weirdly enough. Like the Attorney General's office, who had been involved in that, had subpoenaed that. And so I just contacted the investigator, who was a good source of mine, Bill East, and just said, hey, Bill, can I see that? He said, yeah, come on over. You know, whatever time he gave me a time or whatever to come over, and he just had it laying out for me. And so I just took notes, you know, so that's how I got that story. But yeah, he, And I just read the story. And basically what it was, in this interview, Bowers talked about the Mississippi Burning case. Bowers was one of seven Klansmen who got convicted. The rest of the 18 walked away.
So they were tried and convicted of civil rights.
Federal conspiracy to deprive people of civil rights, essentially, that charge.
And they, you know, had very small terms. A couple of people had.
Oh, yeah. The most any of them had was 6 years, which was Bowers. So Bowers, in this interview, said he was quite delighted to be convicted of these federal charges and have the main instigator of the entire affair walk out of the courtroom a free man. And he was referring to a guy named Edgar Ray Killen, or as he's known locally, Preacher Killen. So, you know, I called Preacher Killen up. We talked for quite a while. Finally, at some point, he said, "There's some guy in Jackson just keeps stirring things up and stirring things up." And I didn't have the heart to tell him it was me. So I took him and his wife out for catfish.
There's great scenes. Again, I keep telling people the book, what we're doing now is great. It's a tease to the book because the whole description of that dinner is fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you.
No, it is.
Took him and his wife out for catfish because really the other alternative that he gave me was to go to his house. And it was like he lived way out. And the only time it would meet me is like 9 o'clock at night. And I knew, like, he lived way out. And in addition to, I'm thinking to myself, that's an awful late hour to meet anybody. And this is a remote area. And I just don't feel comfortable with this. So I just said, "Hey, Ken and I, you know, treat you and your wife to dinner," you know, because he was telling me he was working this other area. He could, you know, and I was like, "Well, how about I take y'all to dinner?" And he's like, "Oh, yeah, sure." I said, what about catfish? "Oh, I love catfish." And anyway, so I took him to those $8.95 all you can eat catfish places. And just started talking to him about this. I had talked to him on the phone already. But ask him about, you know, whether he's involved in killing three civil rights workers. And he essentially, you know, denied that. And then I just asked him, you know, what do you think should happen to people that were responsible? And he's like, "I'm not going to say they were wrong." And then he proceeded to tell me the story about himself when Dr. King was assassinated. At that moment in time, the FBI didn't know who did it. So they kind of sent out FBI agents, took what you might call the usual suspects. So they show up at his doorstep. He won't talk to them, but one of the agents leaves his cards. Time goes on. One day, Preacher Killen picks up the card. He's known as Preacher Killen, so that's why I'm using that nickname. Calls the agent, wants to know who killed King. And the agent's like, "Why do you want to know?" And Killen says, "Man, I want to shake his hand." And as if that wasn't chilling enough, we're walking out of the restaurant, and I'm getting ready to get in my car, right? And he comes, and I'm thinking he's coming to say something to me, you know what I mean? Like, you know, something he forgot to say or whatever. Instead, he walks past me and looks at my license tag. And I'm just like, "Oh, no." Because I knew back then, if you had somebody's license tag, you could find out where they lived. It was, they don't let you do that now, but back then you could. Like, if you had somebody's license tag, you could find exactly where they, like, get their address. And I was just thinking to myself, "Oh my goodness."
So to walk into these, now again, many years have passed, and someone would say, "They're not going to do anything to you." Well, I don't think that's true. You know, you're out in the wilderness, all of a sudden there could be a bullet in you, and you could be in his cesspool or whatever. And I want to add a little excerpt, to read a little excerpt from your book. It was an encounter you had with a neighbor. And it says, when I walked out one morning to get my newspaper, my neighbor stopped me. I was in Philadelphia this weekend, he said. You know, the Klan wants to kill you. He chuckled. I told him if they wanted to know where you lived, it would cost them big bucks. He laughed again. I did my best to fake a smile. And you also write in your book that your wife wasn't really comfortable all the time or happy with these trips you were taking into the lion's den.
Yeah, I have to confess, you know, because you get a bit of distance between some of the stuff. And I kept journals and everything like that. But in terms of the writing of it, I look at it now and I go, man, I was just crazy.
Well, your wife agreed. Your wife agreed as well. Every time you did.
Yeah, she was not happy with me a lot of the time because I kept pursuing it. It's like she kept wanting me to just leave it alone. It's like, look, you know, you've done one of these cases. Keep leave it alone.
I understand.
You know.
In the process, of course, the trials and the ultimate, you know, what happened, we'll talk about that. It's amazing. But you also on the sad side, you were, as part of interviewing everyone, I mean, you interviewed witnesses, you dug up information and gave it to whoever. I mean, you in the paper, things would come out in paper. People were pissed at you. I mean, community, you know, the people.
Oh, yeah. People mad at me.
You know, I mean, hey, nature of the, you know, of newspapers, but you also connected with the families.
Oh, yeah. No, that was the real reward, was getting to know the families and connecting with them. And to this day, I have very good relationships with all those families. So, yeah, it's been a real blessing.
And so, again, one of the things, not so much for you, you weren't in charge of it, but digging the case up again after all those years, not like a couple of years, are they saying, all right, I've got to live through this again. And as we know, it eventually became national news. And so it's on their TVs. It's on their, you know, we're now talking about 2000. So we've got all the cable news shows and whatever. So it's out there. And in their minds, they got to say, on one hand, I think you do say that in the book, a couple of them say, well, this is good if it gets justice, but if it's just another acquittal. Now, Jerry, you were a court reporter for the Clarion Ledger, in addition to this investigative work you were doing almost on the side. So you've seen a lot of trials. What was your opinion of the lawyering on both sides of the aisle, so to speak?
I mean, here's the deal. All the other trials, I didn't have that much criticism for, you know, the way that the defense or the prosecution got handled. And yeah, there were mistakes made. It always are. But that one, it was, you know, the prosecutors did not do a good job and they were not well prepared. And the defense was even more inept. So that was kind of what happened. And I know, trying to beat up now some people I know well and like, but I'm just being honest about it. I think anybody watching that, because it's on video, it's on C-SPAN. If people ever want to go watch it, it's on C-SPAN.
To rewind for just a moment, back to the original trial, the original federal violation of civil rights trial in 1966. Edgar Killen was charged in that trial, but he was not convicted. It was a hung jury. So tell the story about that. That's kind of fascinating.
That was in the federal trial. And that's what, when I went, that's one of the things I always did with these old cases, is I would go and interview the jurors in the case. Inevitably, I'd find out something. And it turned out to be, in that case, I was interviewing the daughter of one of the jurors, who told me that her dad told her that the lone holdout had basically said that she could never convict a preacher. And so that was, and it was an 11-1 vote. And so I did that story, and you know, I did a ton of stories on this. I mean, and that was the other frustrating thing is, you know, you dig up particular evidence. Like I found a threat, and Killen went to prison for it. Actually, there was a threat he had made on a telephone call that was recorded, and I found the recording. I mean, after all those years, from 1974 is when he was convicted, and I found the recording in archives. Shocked that I found it, and I listened to it, and I talked to law professor Don Cochran, who worked on the Birmingham church bombing case and was also a state prosecutor. So he knew state law as well as federal law. And he's like, yeah, you could get this in. And so I wrote about it, but they didn't do anything. It's like they didn't try to get it in. And I just, there were so many things like that, you know, that were kind of bizarre. I mean, like, they didn't try to get that in. They didn't try to get in. There was a statement by a Klansman, essentially a confession by a Klansman that detailed all the killing. You had Jim Jordan testified. So you had his testimony was read to the jury. But then there was a statement by this Klansman named Horace Doyle Barnett. Well, for whatever reason, I don't think it was a good judgment on the part of the defense. The defense tried to enter Barnett's statement into evidence, and the prosecution, for whatever knee-jerk reaction to it, going, no, we don't want it in there. Instead of like thinking for a second and going, wait a minute, if we get that evidence in, we can really convict Killen, because it's very damning of Killen. That statement is not like it gets Killen off the hook. It's very damning.
Now, Jerry, you got to admit, there was a lot of dark comedy in this trial. Not certainly the case itself, but the trial. Witnesses dying. In one case, one of the key witnesses for the prosecution was killed when he fell off a cherry picker and fractured his skull. And then even Edgar Killen himself was almost killed in an accident and in the middle of the trial.
Yeah, there was some concern he might die. You know, what he was doing, he was out. He cut trees. I mean, that's kind of what he did. He was an independent, I guess you'd call logger, whatever you want to call it. And so the tree fell and literally hit him on top of the head, which again sounds like a joke too. You know, like we always think of Wile E. Coyote, you know, the old cartoons, you know. And literally that's what happened. It's like a Wile E. Coyote cartoon. He literally the soil was muddy beneath him, and so it just knocked him down instead of killing him. It should have killed him, but the soil was soft enough that when it drove him downward, it, you know, but it broke both his legs. It did break both his legs.
But Edgar was able to return to the trial in a wheelchair, albeit. And the trial did progress, and the testimony on both sides and the witnesses were quite fascinating. But I'll leave that to folks to read it in the book. So we now get to deliberation, jury deliberation.
It took a while for the jury deliberations. I mean, it was over more than one day. Like, they started on one day, and then it went over to another day.
And they, and you, again, everyone, like in all trials, are going, is this good? Is it, you know, the time?
Well, and the vote was, that point was 6-6. So when I found that out, I was, your question became, what are they 6-6 on? And I presumed it was murder. And, you know, and if it wasn't, if it was manslaughter, then you were really in trouble.
But as it turned out, they were hung up 6-6 on whether it should be murder or manslaughter. Once they sort of coalesced around manslaughter, then there was not an issue of, you know, his guilt or innocence. It became 12-0 that he was guilty. After the verdict was rendered, you discovered that the Barnett statement had it been allowed in to the trial, would have made a difference in the outcome.
Became quite a bit of discussion about that because I shared it with one of the jurors and he was like, if we'd had this, we would have convicted him of murder. And I knew it. I mean, because, he says to one of the Klansmen, you know, that they have a bulldozer ready. Well, you wouldn't, I mean, what do you need a bulldozer for unless you're going to bury, you know, you already knew you're going to be burying bodies at that point, you know. So it's obvious that, you know, it was a murder that was going to transpire.
And so, again, everyone thinks everything's okay, and look, at he's going to go to jail. He's
right, exactly.
He's given heavy sentences. And then
he got 60 years total.
And he, of course, is going to appeal. So then he, which is his right, and because Absolutely. It's not a capital case, it's not murder,
Correct.
He asks for bail.
Yeah, you can do what's called an appeal bond. Like if it's short of a capital crime, you can ask for an appeal bond so that you can stay out until the conviction is affirmed. Essentially, you don't have to stay in incarcerated all that time.
But. Now, what was his basis, which of course is then proven not true? What was his argument that he shouldn't be just, you know, you can't just say, I want to be out. He had to present reasons why. And what were
he said when he took the oath, he was like holding up his right hand and with his left, and he was telling the judge he was either in the wheelchair or or in the bed, like he couldn't get around, and so all that happens, and the judge goes, okay.
Allow me to interject that at this time Attorney General Jim Hood's office came across evidence that Killen's brother, J.D., was willing to pay $3,000 to kill the judge if he did not let Killen out of prison on an appeal bond. But I interrupt. So the wheelchair-bound invalid, Edgar Killen, is released into the town. And then someone sees something and they talk to you, don't they?
Yeah, someone, pointed me to it, but essentially a deputy sheriff happened to witness Edgar Ray Killen filling up his truck with gas, right? And so it said he was walking around without, didn't have his wheelchair at all. And so I wound up doing a story. On it. I'll never forget the judge called me, was asking me about the credibility of the deputy sheriff, and I was just like, well, it's the deputy sheriff. And so that judge ends up having a hearing on it, and not only him, but a whole bunch of other people testified about how Killen was going around and shaking their hand and, just the whole bit, it was just, and then by the end of the hearing, the judge is like, I feel like a fraud has been committed on this court, And so he sent Killen back to prison. It was like, I have to say, from a nonfiction standpoint, I love being able to write it. I thought it was a nice, I love those kind of things, where you think it's over and then you realize, oh, wait a minute,
So thankfully the judge was not murdered and Killen's appeal was denied and he was sentenced to prison where he died in January 11th, 2018 at the age of 92. I do want to toss in one more example of where truth is stranger than fiction. Before the indictments, even a white supremacist by the name of Barrett was going to set up a booth in the Mississippi State Fair where people could go and shake hands and get autographs from Mr. Killen. And you wrote a story about it, and I do want to quote it. You said, "Visitors to next month's Mississippi State Fair may gawk at their reflections in the funhouse, witness the Mississippi State Championship mule pull, or shake hands with the key suspect in the Klan's 1964 killings of three civil rights workers."
It's not
I'm sorry,
over.
I'm sorry, Jerry, your whole book is like that.
Yeah, it is.
I'm
it
sorry.
Is.
Every page, it's like, okay. And then it's, oh, no. And then again, something that is, I don't know the correct word, you know, I don't want to use ludicrous, but it's like, no, come on. This is, you're writing fiction now. This is not real.
I know. That's what I love about it. That's what I love about not, I like to be able to, you know, be able to write nonfiction in a way where people can, it feels like a novel, you know, that kind of thing. And that's what I like. I love books like that.
Now, there's one more player in this saga that I do want to talk about that through the ages has been called Mr. X, and he played a very big, important part in this case. And of course, being who you are, you decided you wanted to chase down the identity of Mr. X.
Well, Mr. X is a really fascinating character in the Mississippi Burning saga. You know, it was reported out at the time, even the same day that the FBI discovered the bodies, it was even reported out that, you know, there have been $30,000 paid to this unnamed informant, Mr. X, who told where the bodies were buried, right? And so this, you know, remained a mystery for decades. I mean, no one knew who this was. I mean, certainly it was kind of like, you know, in the Watergate case, you know, you've got, you know, this mysterious individual who provides information and nobody knows who it actually is. And there are plenty of guesses who that is. And so I first dove into that in like, you know, 2000 or so, the first time I kind of dove into that issue, who really is this guy? And so there was a bit of a clue in Philip Dre basically co-wrote this book about the civil rights movement, We Are Not Afraid. And in it, they quoted an FBI agent as saying that Mr. X was a law enforcement officer in Neshoba County. Okay, I'm going to start with this premise. Who would that include? And so it wouldn't have been the, you know, Cecil Price or any of these people that were the killers. I mean, that's, you know, were involved in some way in the killing. And so I just started looking into each one of them. And the ones that were alive, I talked to. And the ones that were dead, I talked to their families. At the same time, and it was roughly about the same time, I started interviewing Joe Sullivan. Okay. And Joe Sullivan, who's the kind of the chief inspector from the FBI, who was the guy over this particular case, directly over this case, reported directly to Hoover. Okay. So I started pumping him for information about Mr. X. Oh, I just, anything and everything I could get out of him. And, you know, I called him. I don't know how many times I talked to him. Dozens of times we talked about, I call up and ask about, I'd throw a name out and he'd say, no, you know, I can't say, or I promise this guy I'm not going to say. But it was kind of cat and mouse, because he would say, well, I first met Mr. X and he told me where he met him, you know, and he was a law enforcement officer and it was the gathering of all these law enforcement officers. And so you could kind of play this game, and he would give me lots and lots of clues. So he was kind of happy in a way to let me figure it out, but he wasn't going to give it away. So, and he liked me, and I really liked him. He was just an incredible guy. And so just over time, began to collect all these clues, essentially, about where he first met Mr. X, what his experience was like with Mr. X. And so he told me that Mr. X told him this information over dinner at the Holiday Inn in Meridian, Mississippi. And then he said he was a steak man, you know, and so he had a steak. And so then I went back to his family, and his family's like, yeah, you love steaks, you know? And so all these little pieces that Sullivan gave me, you know, began to fit with Maynard Keene. And here's the other wild part of this. So this $30,000 literally arrived in a briefcase in Mississippi in cash, and they used some of it for the exhumation of the bodies. Like, they went and hired bulldozers. This is where it's wild. So Sullivan finds out from Maynard Keene who you know, where the bodies are buried. The very next day, and this is not an FBI record, this is in, of all places, the Sovereignty Commission record, Mississippi Sovereignty Commission record. The thing you have to remember is they're not talking to the civil rights folks. They're talking to the Klansmen. And so they're talking to Price. They're talking to Rainey. Talking to all these guys. And so the very next day, Sullivan, this lets you know how genius Sullivan is. And of course, he was CIA during the World War II. And so he was a counterintelligence guy. I mean, he was really smart this way. So he sent out his agents the next day to start offering a reward. So why would you offer a reward unless you already knew, you know what I mean? Why would you offer a reward when you already knew where the bodies were buried? And then you start thinking about it. It's like, yes, that's because then everybody starts suspecting everybody who took the reward. Oh, wait, Joe got him a new bass boat. He must have got that $30,000, you know? And so it sows dissension within the ranks. And Sullivan was a genius that way. And so literally, even Hoover thought they paid $30,000 to an informant to tell where the bodies were buried. And it was very clear Maynard Keene didn't get any money for it. He did it out of the goodness of his heart.
Okay, so before we go, I do want to ask you about the poster behind you. Tell me about the Mississippi Investigator.
Center for Investigative Reporting.
I know you're still connected. Tell us, I find that I did.
Yeah, so I started that. The Clarion Ledger was offering a series of buyouts, and I think it was about the third go round for a buyout. And I thought, well, I guess I better take this. Keep giving me clues. So I took the buyout and started a nonprofit called the Mississippi Center for Investigative Reporting. We opened our doors in 2019. And so we have done that since. We Mississippi needs more investigative reporting, not less. And so that's kind of what we do. This past year, since really summer of 2022, we've been working with the New York Times. We've been investigating sheriffs here in Mississippi, and it's been incredible. I mean, we've published, you know, allegations of sexual abuse, rape, you know, beatings, torture. We did a story on the Goon Squad, and that's what they call themselves. that carried out this campaign for at least 20 years, kind of a campaign of terror, really, on the community just outside of Jackson. So, well, and the Goon Squad case, they just stole stuff. They just stole stuff. I mean, there was a deputy they raided, his house, no warrant, broke into his trailer, and they took all his guns, all his ammunition, I mean, everything. He never got, I think he got one gun back, but it wasn't even his real gun. It was some other deputy goes, well, you can have this one, you know, and it was, you know, it was like that kind of situation. So it was just awful. All the stuff they did, and they planted drugs, and they planted guns, and oh my goodness, it's hard to believe we'd have this happen in 2023. And they shot the guy in the mouth. I mean, it's just, you know, they were doing the old Russian roulette thing. You know, they were taking the bullet out, put the gun in the mouth, and click. You know, and the second go round, they thought they had emptied the chamber, and they hadn't. And so when they pulled the trigger, it just went, you know.
And this was on a suspect. I mean, this was on someone that they had arrested.
Two black men. They had no warrant, nothing. I mean, it's horrific. The six of them have pleaded guilty now to federal charges, and they're supposed to be sentenced later this month. So we'll see what happens. But I presume a number are going to face pretty serious time.
And so we'll close with, so how do you feel about checking over your shoulder nowadays?
Now I have two for sheriff departments, apparently. You know, it goes with the territory. I mean, I must be a real primitive thinker, because I always take everything back to the playground. You know, to me, these, you know, when I was a little kid, I was just a shrimp. I was just, you know, and just always got the crap beaten out of me by kids, terrorized by kids. And it's all, I just don't react well to bullies. And that's what I feel like these guys are. They're just a bunch of bullies. You know, they're just bullying people. Whether we're talking about the Klan or we're talking about this Goon Squad. I mean, they're bullies. That's what they are. They're bullies. And, you know, it doesn't make it, you know, just because it's law enforcement doing it doesn't make it right, you know?
Well, Jerry, I'd like to say I'm hopeful, but I really am fearful for this country and the hate and the division, and it's getting bigger and bigger. And so we can talk about Mississippi, or we can talk about Alabama, or we can talk about Texas, but the hate is everywhere.
It's everywhere. I mean, look at what happened up in Buffalo a few years ago, where the guy went in the grocery store and killed, I think, 10 people. And then the guy from the Dallas area drove all the way to El Paso and killed 24 Hispanic Americans, shot another 24, injured another 24. And he said, you know, the reason he did that was to halt the invasion, which is the exact same language that Sam Bowers used in the summer of 1964. You know, about these civil rights workers are coming, and we've got to halt this invasion.
There you go. So, Jerry, if any of my listeners would like to get in touch with you, what's the best mode of communication?
Well, they can email me. My email is Jerry, Jerry.Mitchell, Mitchell, at Mississippi, all spelled out, CIR.org. And that's our nonprofit, and we're now part of Mississippi Today. And if people are interested, they like, you know, civil rights history, I have a daily post that runs on the front of the Mississippi Today. kind of on this day, and it lets people know about the history. It's history that really I knew nothing about until I moved to Mississippi. And so we really need to teach these things, because I think, you know, as Merle Evers said, we keep repeating our history because we don't know our history. And I think there's a lot of truth to that.
And so basically you are indirectly or directly advocating for critical race theory?
People may say it that way. I'm all for the truth. How about that? I mean, I you know, to me, it's not about, it's just being truthful. And I'll give a simple example. In our own lives, the best way to live is to be honest about yourself and honest about your past and honest about your present. Because if you live a lie, it's going to catch up with you at some point. It's going to bite you.
Well, Jerry, again, I want to thank you for joining us today on Murder Most Foul. Again, ladies and gentlemen, the book is Race Against Time. A reporter reopens the unsolved murder cases of the civil rights era. And although today we have concentrated on the Mississippi burning case, there are other cases in your book that are equally fascinating. So again, I hope Murder Most Foul listeners will pick up the book. I got mine at a library, but you can buy them online. This is my little bailiwick, my little soapbox. If you have a brick and mortar bookstore in your town, please go get it there. If they don't have it, they will order it for you. You may pay an extra dollar, but you are supporting a business. And I have nothing against Amazon. I shop Amazon. I have to, because it's the only place I can find things. But when you have an option, please use a local bookstore so you can get it there. And it is a great, again, I cannot stress enough, it's a wonderful read. We've talked about this case, but as Jerry has said, there's humor, unintentional humor, things you would say, how is that possible that they lost this or this happened, all within the cases that are so serious for our continuing to be a civilization. So once again, thanks, Jerry.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Andy.
So I'd like to thank you folks for kindly tuning in for another episode of Murder Most Foul. If you liked what you heard, I hope you'll tell your friends. Information about the podcast and an email link that can get a message to me can be found at the podcast's website, the address being www.murdermostfoul, all one word, no caps, no spaces, .com. So, until we meet again, stay safe, and for God's sakes, don't murder anyone.